We can get out our Bibles and turn together once again to the book of Job in Job chapter 28. Job 28. I want to ask you all to do something with me right now, and that is, would you join me in thanking Anna Vermock in helping us in leading worship this morning? As I was singing these songs, first of all, if you want to be really encouraged, during the week on the app, we have the songs, at least Monday and Tuesday, from that we sang the previous week. And then starting Wednesday, we have the upcoming worship songs that we'll be singing. And that is put out primarily as a means to help you to prepare your hearts for the service or to reflect back. Well, if you go and you look at what we just got finished singing today, and you think in light of the passage that we're going to look at, you're going to go, my goodness, Anna knew what she was doing when she selected what she selected to prepare us for what we're going to be looking at today. So I pray that'd be a blessing to you as you reflect and think on the proclamations and the truths that you just said. And some of them were some pretty hard truths. You realize you just said, though he slay me, yet I will serve him. Part of what I want to do is ask, did you mean that? Or did you tune out mentally and not even think about what it was that you were saying? There's some serious things, and Job has brought to light a lot of these kinds of serious things. So I hope that that'll prepare and bless you as we look at this text. Now, having said all that, I'm sure many of you, when you walked out this morning, you about got knocked over by those winds this week, didn't you? This has been a windy week. Thanks to the Gill family, we personally had a tree that took out power to about 1,000 homes in the Round Hill area. Those of you that live in Round Hill, yes, that was our tree. I'm not going to say it was our fault, but it was our tree. And it's just been quite a week. But nothing at all compares to what we went through a number of years ago when we lived in Pensacola, Florida. Because it was in Pensacola where we encountered not one but two hurricanes in a 2.5 year period that we were there. And both those hurricanes went directly over our house. One in particular, it wasn't just that the hurricane went over, the eye of the hurricane went directly over our house. And I will never forget it. Because we're sitting in our home, and you know, we didn't have a basement in that thing, so we're just looking out the window because we don't know what else we're gonna do. And I'm watching the winds and that rain and everything that's just pouring down all around us. And then before too much longer, all of a sudden it got real quiet and the sun came out. And that's when I went outside and I walked, and there was like this parade ground directly opposite our home there. And I went and I stood in the middle of that. And here I am in the midst of all this wreckage. There's tree branches all over the place. There's leaves everywhere. There's shingles everywhere on the grounds. There's all kinds of debris. I remember some fencing that was out there too. And then I looked up, and sure enough, I saw, it just looked like this perfect funnel, this perfect tube of emptiness, just completely enveloped by these clouds. And I could just see the clouds as it began to swirl and go around and around. And standing in the eye, that's one of the most surreal things, because it's like God hit the pause button on the storm, and we just got to go out and take a look at it briefly and check it out. So we're out there, we look at it, we're blown away, and then the eye continues to move, and then we're starting to feel a little bit of the breeze, and so we head back inside, because hurricanes are known for having an encore, and I did not want to be around for that. Well, I share all that to say that what we experience physically, I feel like Job has been through in circumstances very much like that hurricane, because everything in his life has been affected by it. His property has been destroyed. His income has been taken from him. All of that pales in comparison to the loss of life. All of his children have been killed, all of them, within a moment's notice. His health has been taken away. And then on top of that, too, his reputation was stripped away from him. All of it mangled by the destruction of this hurricane that Satan was allowed by God to bring into his path and to place upon him. Well, as we've been looking at it all the way, now that we get to chapter 28, what you're going to find is here we stand in the eye of that hurricane that's engulfed his life. And for a moment, we're going to enter into a time when the whirlwind and all the pain and so forth has briefly stalled out. And here we're going to step back for a moment of calm reflection. And at issue in this reflection with Job is this question: how do we reconcile the justice of God in Job's suffering with the wisdom of God in overseeing it all? Because we feel like if we could somehow get God's wisdom on what it is that he was doing, what he was accomplishing, and behind everything that's going on, maybe we can begin to sort of grasp and get an understanding of God's justice, how that interacts with this, especially since Job was an innocent man, and when all of this makes no sense. Well, when I talk about wisdom and getting this kind of wisdom, let me start by doing this. I got to define my terms first. What is it? I'm going to borrow from an author. The guy's name's Eric Heaton, and he put it like this: wisdom is the ability to cope with life. And sometimes that has to do with morally. You need to make some moral decisions to cope with a situation. Other times it's intellectually that you'll need information. More often than not, it's going to be practically that you need some wisdom on how to live out a particular situation, or relationally. We need a lot of relational wisdom in getting along with others. But it's the ability in life for you to be able to handle what it is that life throws at you so that you can govern that situation, you can respond to it, you can endure it, and you would do so with the right perspective, and I'd go so far as to even say maybe with a little bit of poise. In this chapter, chapter 28, is the meditation on that kind of a wisdom. Now, if instead of preaching this, I had to deliver the book of Job to you in like a play, I have ideas about what I would do. First of all, I would have each person would have an actor assigned to them. You'd have Job, you'd have each of his three friends, you'd have Satan, you know, I would have a voice for God and so forth. But Job and his friends, they would just go back and forth in their discussions amongst one another. But then I would get to chapter 28, and this is where everything changes. Because here, I would have all the lights go out, and I would have the stage just go completely dark. And a single beam of light then would come down and enter on stage left. And there in the stillness, I would try to get the actor Sir David Suchet. For those of you who know him, yes, that's Hercule Poirot himself. You impressed I could say that? He's one of the Agatha Christie murder mystery detectives and just a profound speaker. But here, I would have him step forward, and at this point, I would have him deliver the words that we're going to see in this chapter. Now, why wouldn't I get the actor who plays Job to step forward and to give this? Because I'm not entirely sure that Job is the person who's speaking here. Those of you that have an ESV study Bible, I'm not trying to discredit it, but they typically credit this chapter in the little notes that you get in front saying Job's discussion. I don't think it's Job, though. And I think a lot of Bible scholars would agree with that, and I think a good case can be made that this is the narrator, the same person who gave us the first few chapters and told us about the events that were going on, the same person who will wrap up the book of Job. And we don't know who this individual is, but I'd have Suchet step in to take on that role. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter who it is that speaks this, because either way, the truth that is behind this remains the same. And with David Suchet on the left of the stage, on the right, I would have another beam of light go out. And from the roof suspended, I would have an individual. And I would have him sort of in sort of a bucket with these ropes that hold him down. And he would be a miner, M-I-N-E-R, somebody who digs for treasure. And I would have him surrounded by the pitch blackness. And it's with this that I would then have David Suchet begin with chapter 28, verse 1. Surely there is a mine for silver and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust and copper is smelted from the rock. So this text begins. It's speaking about an effort to go after and to hunt after something that men consider valuable. In fact, it's so valuable, people will invest their lives. It's so valuable, some people will risk their lives trying to find that thing. And implied within this is the fact that men know how to get it. I will put it like this. They have the ability to cope. They have the wisdom to know where to mine. They have the wisdom to know where to dig and how to get it, what it is that they're after, and to smelt it from the rock. And it's here I would have the guy who's hanging from the bucket to then light a lamp. And then Suchet would continue with verse 3. Man puts an end to darkness. again, implied here, men know how to do this. They have the wisdom to bring light into this circumstance. And to the farthest limit, he searches out the rock in gloom and deep shadow, and he sinks a shaft from habitation, forgotten by the foot, and they hang and swing to and fro far from men. It's the perfect description of people being suspended down into a dark cave, bringing their light such that they can begin to mine. And I thought about this. Have you ever been in total darkness? Oh, I have. When I was a kid, and I distinctly remember this, my family went to Carlsbad Caverns. Some of you may have been there. I see a few heads nodding. And the path is lit such that you could go down deep into the earth. And when you got way down there and you see all these lights that are showing you the enormous sense of volume that this cave holds, then they would make an announcement. They'd turn out the lights, and they would turn out the lights. And I'll tell you what, that was a dark, so dark, you could feel it. I knew right then and there, Lord, I will go anywhere you call me to, but I will not return here. That you have not called me to some sort of an underground ministry, that I know. Because you're in there, it is like you're alive and you know you're in the grave. And if the lights didn't come back on, you're dead. You have no idea how you're going to get out of there. I feel like that's the image that we find with Job. He's like that man mining in the dark. And Job is an individual who's searching. And he's not searching for a treasure. This guy's searching for answers, for wisdom. He's looking for the ability to cope somehow with his very hard questions. Like, what did I do to deserve this, God? Or the other question, what is the meaning behind all this suffering that I'm going through? Verse 5, the earth. From it comes food, and underneath it is turned up as fire. Its rocks are the source of sapphires, and its dust contains gold. And you get what it's saying there. You know, on the surface of the earth, you've got soil, and you've got plants, and from it, you will grow food, and it'll sustain you. You can grow fruit trees, and these things will sustain you. But then you go underneath, and how are you going to extract what's underneath? Well, you got to dig for it. And in that day, too, another way you would do it is by fire. You would take smelting within the mine to get an intense heat such that you could break the rock and extract things from it. Or in some cases, you might even get a superheat going such that if there was gold, you might melt it out of the rock, and then you could collect it once it came out. Well, in a similar way, Job is mining. He most certainly is, to find out the reasons for his suffering. And he says there is a fire burning underneath here, but he couldn't find gold or sapphires as a result. The fire is burning, but he sees nothing coming from it. And he needs desperately somehow to try to find a reason, a purpose behind his suffering. But instead, he feels like, rather than getting answers, I feel like I'm just falling further and further down into this darkness, into the caverns of grief and of loss, looking for something more precious than gold. And you know what it is. This is a guy who's searching for meaning, just like you and I do. When we're going through intense suffering, we look for it. We want God to speak in it. Verse 7, he goes on, he explains a little bit about the animals and how animals don't have the wisdom. They don't have the knowledge as to how to go into the mine and extract these kinds of precious metals, and they don't have wisdom. He says in verse 7, the path no bird of prey knows, nor has the falcon's eye caught sight of it, and the proud beasts have not trodden it. Nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He put his hand on the flint, meaning men, and he overturns the mountains at the base, and he hews out channels through the rocks, and his eye sees anything precious, and he dams up the streams from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out to the light. Now, when you take all that and you summarize it, what he's trying to get at, he says man figures out a way what the animal can't. Man figures out a way. If he wants flint, he becomes really ingenious. And he discovers a way to get it. Man knows how to open the mountains. He discovers and works hard at it. And he knows how to uncover these precious stones after he puts this intense heat into the rock. The fires in verse 10 show us this. And that often in that day too, what you would do is if you had intense heat in a rock, you would dam up a stream such that you could collect water. And then you would channel that water and rush it in while the fire is burning so that the rock would undergo an extreme change in temperature and maybe split open as well. And thus you can find and discover more of the precious stones you're looking for. And that's humanity. We are ingenious. We really are. And when we want to find something that we think is valuable, oh, we find a way. Think about oil under the ocean. Humanity has found a way. It's a complex process. It is an impressive process, but we can dig all the way. We can get through the water to get underneath it, and then to begin to go down and to find that oil. And we can pull diamonds out of the rocks. We can build tunnels through mountains. Anybody here been to the Swiss Alps? A few of you? Yeah, we have been through some of those tunnels, and I'll tell you what, they go for miles, and you just marvel. How did this happen? How could you go this far in and remove all this and make a pathway through? And that's what man has done. I've been to Mobile Bay. There's a tunnel that goes under the water there. Or some of you have been to Virginia Beach, and you've been in the tunnel that goes under the water there. And it's just impressive to think, rather than go over, we will go under, and we can do this. And that's a testimony as to how ingenious man is. You want to know how we're really ingenious? We can teach cats how to use an iPad. That even is not beyond us. All kinds of things that we can do. But even with all that brilliance, there's one thing we still cannot locate. And verse 12 is where that contrast begins. The contrast begins because you find the word but beginning in verse 12. But where can wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Because that, ladies and gentlemen, is the real question. We can dig for miles in the earth, but we cannot plumb the depths of God's ways and understand his mind. Verse 13, he says, man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me, and the sea says, it's not with me. Again, man does not know, because this kind of wisdom doesn't originate with humans. You can't Google it. You can't chat GPT your way through this kind of a wisdom. You can't order it on Amazon and expect it to arrive the next day. This kind of wisdom, this real kind, is the divine kind that is built into the fabric of God's creation. And yet, at the same time, you can't buy it, you can't earn it, and you can't engineer it, and you ultimately can't even fully understand it. Verse 15, he says, pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned, and the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. And the topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. So the point's clear in all this. There's a treasure greater than gold, and there is a wealth greater than anything you'll be able to find on Wall Street. In fact, Proverbs 3:13 speaks to this when it says, blessed is the one who finds wisdom, for she is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Mining for gold is easy compared to mining for wisdom, divine wisdom. Is it good to search for wisdom? You better believe it. But you got to know where its source is. Verse 20. Now the narrator addresses this. Where then does wisdom come from? And where is the place of understanding? Now, if you got your pen, this is where you need to underline it. Verse 21. Thus it is hidden. Highlight that, circle that, remember that. It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abaddon and death say, with our ears, we've heard a report of it. So Abaddon and death, these are the places of the underworld. And so his point is, whether you want to go above the surface or below the surface of the earth, nothing can uncover this kind of a wisdom. And no amount of suffering or science or speculation is going to give you the answers to it. Now, several years back, for those of you that were here, when we were looking at the very beginning of this, I sent you to chapter 39, and we looked at the ostrich. And in verses 13 to 17 of chapter 39, I told you that was a place that somewhat summarized the essence of where this book is going, because it said, God has deprived the ostrich of wisdom, and implied behind it was, And so it is the same. It is hidden from the natural man. You can't know the mind of God. You can't grasp what he's doing. Because the source of this kind of wisdom, ladies and gentlemen, is not found in creation. The creation can show you things about God, but you can't know God and you can't know his thinking merely by looking at it unless he reveals his mind. Then you can begin to know. And you can't mind this kind of wisdom because it's not in creation. This kind of wisdom is above creation, ladies and gentlemen. Verse 23, he says, God understands its way and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and he sees everything under the heavens. When he imparted weight to the wind, meaning he determined how hard it would blow. When it knocked you in the face this morning when you walked out the front door, he was the one who imparted that wind. And he meted out the waters by measure. So he is the one who has determined the volume of the sea. When he set a limit for the rain, he determines when it starts and when it stops. And a course for the thunderbolt. He determines where it's going to strike next. And then he saw and declared it. He established it and also searched it out. Now, all these descriptions here, these are all what we call acts of nature. Do all of acts of nature happen by chance? No. No, they don't. They are controlled by God himself. He determines them. And if they happen by his wisdom, then the outcomes that happen as a result of their occurrences are not random outcomes. They are purposed, which means that there is a why behind their occurrence. And yet the answer to why is all in the hands of the Creator. And we can't necessarily figure it out, being the creatures. Only he knows the balance of wind and rain, the pattern of thunder and lightning. The best we can do is check the Weather Channel and hope that they're right on any given day. But he knows the source of all things. And this is what brings us to the ultimate conclusion of where this chapter is going. It's in verse 28. To man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. Now the word Lord here is the word Adonai in Hebrew. It's the only place in the book of Job where it's used. And that I think within here is sort of the punchline. This is the plot twist in what we're looking at when we're looking at the story of Job. Because wisdom isn't about knowing why everything happens. We think it is, but it isn't. Or understanding how it all fits together. Rather, it's about knowing who holds it all together. And who it is Adonai, the Lord. And wisdom, ultimately, is submitting to his rule. It's submitting to his purposes. Are you ready for this? Even if I don't understand them. That is wisdom. Not the why. Trusting in the who. Psalm 9:10 says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. And any wisdom that we get from God can only come about because he has chosen to reveal it to us. That's it. When God speaks to us through his word, which means any knowledge that I get, ladies and gentlemen, it's an act of grace by God that he has chosen to submit and to give that to us. Now, this is an important chapter because it's the first one that begins a, sort of a ramp up in getting you ready for when God is going to speak to Job. There will be a revelation as he addresses Job specifically. Next, you've got chapters 29 through 31. Job has a response. We've already looked at that. After that, we're going to look at a fellow named Elihu. We'll look at that next Sunday, somebody that we haven't seen so far in the reading of this book. And then after that, you're going to have Job, or you're going to have God himself speak. And when he does, wisdom will come forth. And you might not like it, but wisdom will come forth. But this chapter, this is the eye of the hurricane. And in that moment, when just for a second, everything is calm, and Job gets a glimpse of the blue sky in the middle of the wreckage. He doesn't understand the storm, but he's reminded of who governs it. That the wisdom of God is not to answer us in our why questions, but rather to give us the revelation as to who he is and call us to trust in that. Now, the New Testament expands on this a little bit for us, doesn't it? Because you go into the book of Colossians chapter 2, it says this of Jesus. In him, meaning Jesus, are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Because in Jesus, you find the wisdom of God. You find truth and you find grace. You find the divine and you find human. You find love. You find the justice of God enacted. You find the mind of God revealed to humanity in him. And Job's friends, were they mining? Yes, they were. They had their minds that they were going through and trying to determine what truth was, but each of them was going to the wrong place. I'll go back to the stage of truth here. You might remember Eliphaz. Eliphaz is a guy, he leans on his reason, but also on his experience. Remember he talked about, well, I felt like the Spirit brushed past me, and then I was sort of overwhelmed to tell you these things, Job. He's mining in the wrong place, going for some sort of spiritual, mystical experience. We had Bildad. And he was mining also, but he went straight to tradition. What have the forefathers said? What are those things that we've heard from people in the past? And this became where he rested his source of knowledge and wisdom. And then you had Zophar, who dug into a little bit of his own ability, both reason and emotion, sort of kind of at the front of a stage of truth, and him giving Job the reasons why Job was going through what he was going through and trying to give him wisdom. But here's what they didn't speak on. They didn't speak based on God's revelation. And when we have our stage of truth, all of these things God uses to help us learn and discover what truth is. But when Scripture speaks and Scripture's clear, we're done. Everything else has to get in line. And can I give you a great example of this? My experience has never had me discover a dead man come back to life. Not only that, my reason says dead can't come back to life like that. But the Bible says the crux of our entire faith rests upon a dead man that God brought back to life. And because my reason and my experiences don't line up, they have to take a back seat. And instead, I've got to rest in what has God revealed to me, and I walk in that. And what happens when maybe God hasn't revealed some of the answers to my questions? I'm kind of held in a state of suspense, aren't I? Where I'm having to trust him. To say, well, I don't get it, but I get you, and that'll be enough for me. Because it's God's revelation is where our search must always begin, and it's what makes everything, in essence, to enable us to understand the truth in God. And all of the other means that we have to determine this, again, they got to take a back seat when God has spoken and his revelation. And you are not going to find that kind of wisdom and the ability to cope when it doesn't make sense. You're not going to find it in the depths of the earth. You're not going to find it in the halls of academia. And you sure aren't going to find it in your feeling and in your gut today. You can only find it ultimately in the person of Jesus Christ, the revealed truth of God. And he is revealed to us in Scripture, God's revelation. He is the one who entered into the storm for us. He is the one who, during a storm, could cry out, "Peace, be still," and the storms would settle. But he's also the one who, in his great storm, when he hung upon a cross, could have called down legions of angels, but he didn't. He kept a silence about him, enduring the worst act of injustice. And that moment would end with his words, "It is finished." And the things that the cross reveals to us, ladies and gentlemen, are what the world thinks is foolishness. But to you and I, it reveals the incredible wisdom of God, even if we don't understand all the mechanics behind it. We don't understand everything that God's doing. But in that, somehow he found a way to preserve his justice while at the same time opening the door to forgiveness for us and our rebellion against him and our love for us. So what do we do with all this? Well, what happens when your life feels like a hurricane? And there's a lot of carnage and damage that is going on around you. And you can't see even all the destruction that's going on because all the pain that you're going through and you're encountering. Here's what you have to remember. You may not be able to explain the storm, but you can trust the one who's in command of it. You can't. And this text reminds us that when we're in a storm, our call, sometimes you just need to take a moment and stand in the eye. When you stand in the eye, you look up and you look at the blue sky of his sovereignty over it all. And then you have to let his peace be your wisdom while you go through it. Because when you've got the fear of the Lord, what you'll have is a humble reverence about you that says, God, I don't have to understand this. I would like to, but I don't have to understand it. Instead, what I have to do is trust in you. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where the calm will begin.